Hello and welcome to this special episode of the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. My name is Seth Paradin, historian and deputy director of the Mississippi Armed Forces Museum back at Camp Shelby in Mississippi. And with me is my co-host, esteemed co-host, retired Navy Captain Bill Todi, former skipper of the Fast Attack Submarine USS Indianapolis, submarine commander, commodore of Submarine Squadron 3 in Pearl Harbor, and many other postings. How you doing, Bill?
I'm doing great, Seth. This is the first time we've done it live together in the same room, and if it doesn't go off well, this may be the last time we do it live and together in the same room.
That is very true. So obviously we're not in our normal locations. We're here in Benicia, California, for the 2023 reunion of the USS Indianapolis Legacy Organization. As such, we thought it would be most appropriate for this particular episode to talk about Indy's World War II history. And because we're here in Benicia, Bill, you are definitely resplendent in your navy whites. As I sit here like a schmuck in my jeans and plaid shirt, why are you dressed as
you are? We're both in uniform, Seth. That's
indeed
your uniform,
it
too.
It is.
So, yeah. So, obviously, Seth, when you wear a uniform as a retired Navy guy, you can't put anything on the uniform that you didn't earn. But there's no rules against you taking things off of the uniform that you did earn. And so what I've done today is I've removed everything that I would normally wear on my, this is the service dress white uniform, that didn't exist in World War II. So for that reason, I'm not wearing my Joint Chiefs of Staff pin, because that wasn't invented yet. I'm not wearing my Command at Sea pin, because that wasn't invented yet. So I've dressed down my service dress uniform to what would be appropriate in 1945, because we were kind of living history through the Indianapolis as it was in 1945. And the other thing you'll notice is I only have one row of ribbons, because we didn't give out many awards back then. We give a lot more awards out now, and so I stripped down to just a single row of ribbons. And this is the uniform that officers in the Navy would wear most of the time, unless they were aboard ship, in which case they would wear what we call wash khakis, which is exactly what it sounds, khaki uniform that you can wash. And so, unfortunately, when I retired from the Navy, I threw away most of my khakis, all of my khakis. So all I have left is the whites.
Yeah,
that's why I'm here.
The chokers aren't going in the Maytag, I can assure you.
Yeah, but the chokers were it. We didn't have summer whites yet. The Brits did, and we adopted the summer white uniform from the Royal Navy a few years later. But in World War II, this is pretty much it.
Well, I mean, look at this. This is amazing, right? I mean, come on. So let's get to what we're talking about here today, Bill. We're going to talk about the design history and the battle history of the USS Indianapolis.
Right.
So everybody in this room knows the history of the Indianapolis, but for those of you who are listening to this later or watching this on YouTube, you might not. And spoiler alert, we're not going to talk about what happens to the Indianapolis, because everybody knows what happened to the Indianapolis. We're going to save that for another episode another day.
And Seth, I did want to introduce a few people that we have in the audience. Again, we've got some pretty noteworthy people here that I think, you know, are a tribute to this fine ship and the legacy that it still continues to carry forward. So as we all know, everybody who watches this podcast is a big World War II history buff. You know that the Indianapolis was the flagship of the Fifth Fleet. That was Admiral Spruance's, he was a four-star at the time, his Fifth Fleet. And so he rode Indianapolis, and we actually have the grandchildren of Admiral Spruance in the audience here today, Ellen Spruance Holscher and David Bogart. And if the two of you could stand up, are you still here? Yeah. It's so wonderful to talk about Admiral Spruance, as we've done so many times, Seth, on the podcast. And David Bogart still actually lives in the Spruance house. And one of these days, we hope to get David to show us on the podcast Admiral Spruance's house. Next, we have, and I don't know if she's in the room, she might be out of the room working right now. But again, everybody knows the story of the Indianapolis, the way it was discovered by a Ventura pilot. And that Ventura pilot's name was Chuck Gwynn. And we have Chuck Gwynn's daughter here, and I don't think she's in the room. I think she's outside the room working. But Jane Gwynn Goodall's here with us, and we're very happy to have her. Next, I want Sarah. Yeah. And if you haven't read the 2018 book titled Indianapolis, a 50-year fight to, I can't remember the subtitle. I keep doing this. But the authors of that latest book on the history of the Indianapolis are here, Lynn Vincent and Sarah Vladek. Next, we have our retired Admiral and Director of Naval History and Heritage Command, who's a great friend of the Indianapolis family, Sam Cox. Admiral Cox, are you here? There he is, yeah. Welcome, Sam.
Okay, I'm jumping out of the live recording of the podcast right now to correct an error. Do you ever have one of those moments where you think you forgot something, but you can't remember what it is? Well, I'm back home from Benicia, California, where we just returned from the reunion of the USS Indianapolis Legacy Group. But that reunion included our one remaining USS Indianapolis survivor. His name is Harold Bray, and he was attending this live recording of our podcast with Seth and I. And I went through my list of introductions, and there he was sitting in the audience. And how in the heck could I forget to introduce the most important man in the room? But I did. Inexcusable, inexplicable, but here he is sitting in the front of the audience, and we were so frantically trying to prepare for this podcast, I just kind of dropped sync on the introductions. And forgive me, Harold, for not calling you out in real time, live, as everybody was sitting there. And 1,000 apologies, and hopefully you can forgive me. You've known me for 25 years. You stole one of the plates from my submarine in 1998. So hopefully you can forgive me for this. Now back to the podcast.
And so that's really incredible that we have all those great supporters of the crew, both survivors and lost at sea of the Indianapolis, Seth.
Absolutely. Thank you all for being here too, by the way, for sitting in this room, listening to Bill and I rattle on for the next hour or so. So let's cut to the chase, Bill. So Indianapolis began her life in 1930 when she was laid down on March 31st of that year. In a relatively short period of construction, Indy was launched a little over a year later on November 7th, 1931. She took her shakedown cruise under her first skipper, Captain John Smealy, was through the Atlantic into Cuban waters in the early part of 1932. She was what was called a treaty cruiser, is what they're known as.
Right, and that refers to the Washington Naval Treaty, which limited the size and displacement, that means weight, of ships post-World War I, because we had this kind of silly notion that if everybody had weapons, then wars would happen, and it turns out that wars happen even when countries don't have significant weapons. But Indy was a treaty cruiser, which meant she was limited in displacement to 10,000 tons. And to fit within that limitation, she had less armor on the ship than most cruisers and certainly battleships did of the day and later. And that limitation on armor would come to haunt her later in life on July 30th, 1945.
It would, and it would also, in my opinion, come to help her out in an incident before that, but we'll get to that when a kamikaze hit her. But a Portland-class cruiser is what she was. To give the specifics, this distinction between the Portland-class and most other American cruisers of the time was that the two ships of the class, it was just Portland and the USS Indianapolis, these two ships were designed and built to be fleet flagships, which is something you're going to hear throughout the rest of this episode and any other time we really talk about Indy. The design was based off of lessons learned from the two previous classes of ships, American heavy cruisers, treaty cruisers that were built before them. The flagship design played a huge role in Indianapolis's life. I mean, this is why Admiral Spruance's grandchildren are here, because he made his second home aboard USS Indianapolis, Indy Maru, as she was called. But the Portland class, and therefore Indianapolis, they were very, very large. You mentioned this earlier about the size of Indianapolis. She was huge for a cruiser. Yeah. She was actually larger in length above water or below water than the USS Arizona.
The battleship,
bigger than
right?
The battleship.
Yeah. I said the Missouri earlier, but it's the battle. Yeah. You're right.
I missed it.
It's a but that's incredible. A cruiser that's longer than a battleship. But that's what these. And she was not only long, she was fast.
Extremely fast. Yeah, she could make better than 32 knots. You know, that's really cooking in those pre-war days, because it's when a battleship could make, you know, as I like to say, 21 knots downhill with a tailwind, the 32 knots in a heavy cruiser is really kicking it. And that is something that Indy would show time and time and time again, and unfortunately would be the one trait that would eventually help seal her fate was her speed.
But like we alluded to earlier, she had a bit of a glass jaw. And what was that?
She did. She was very lightly armored. I got the numbers here. She only packed 3 1/4 inches of belt armor and 2 1/2 inches of deck armor, which 2 1/2 inches of steel is pretty good when you really think about it. But when you're talking about armor-piercing shells or anything like that, or an armor-piercing bomb coming down, or a torpedo, you know, that's not a whole lot of steel to help absorb or deflect some of that force that's coming at you.
Right. And the other thing is that, you know, they focused on armament, whereas a lot of other ships had, you know, battleships in particular, 16-inch guns. They weren't large, as large bore her guns, but there were plenty of them, weren't there?
There were. She carried 9 8-inch rifles, nine 8-inch rifles and 3 triple-gun turrets. These rifles specifically for Indianapolis and Portland had a longer range than some of the other earlier treaty cruisers, and it put them kind of close to the ranges of her future enemy, that being Japan. Japan's heavy cruisers and the Indianapolis and Portland had a similar range in their 8-inch rifles.
Yeah, and that was a great advantage for her. We talked about her power plant and her speed. The combination of the fact that she was configured to carry an admiral of flag quarters, and her speed, she can get where she needed to go quickly, is what caused Admiral Spruance to decide to make it his flagship. Admiral Halsey, as we know, selected a battleship as a flagship, and Admiral Spruance was once asked why he didn't. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, sometimes I need to get out of the fight to go have a conference. And he felt he didn't want to take those big battleship guns out of the fight. He was more comfortable taking a cruiser out. Mm-hmm. And he thought it would be the wrong thing to do to take a battleship out if he had to go somewhere for a conference. So it was the right ship, in my opinion. I tend to side with Spruance over Halsey on a whole bunch of issues. You know that. This is another one where I think he was right.
Right. Well, you know, Indy, you know, aside from having Admiral Spruance aboard, she had President of the United States aboard several times. Franklin Delano Roosevelt made Indianapolis his home many times over the period of early to mid to late 1930s. He rode her on several presidential cruises, not the least of which was Indy served as FDR's ship of state during the first portion of his presidency, and as such was a spit and polish ship, as you're sitting here in your whites. That would not have been an uncommon sight aboard Indianapolis.
No, when the president was aboard, people were on their best behavior, and there was a lot of polishing of the brasswork and things like that, no doubt. 1936, she embarked FDR on a Goodwill cruise to South America. I think a lot of the Indianapolis sailors and crew members and families know about that cruise because we do talk about it a lot with FDR aboard. And this was when he was still fairly ambulatory, mm-hmm. before his polio really started limiting him significantly. He was still limited in his movement, but not as much as later.
And there's an interesting photograph. There's several photographs of that 1936 cruise when FDR was aboard Indy, and you do see him. You know, he's being propped up, but he's standing. There's also pictures of him in a wheelchair, which is something you never see, or very rarely do you see that. And he's on board Indy in one of his wheelchairs.
So yeah. But when Admiral Spruance came aboard, that wasn't the first time Indianapolis served as a flagship,
no,
was it?
It was not. No, she served as a flagship for Scouting Fleet 1 in the late 1930s and served in that role until 1941, which was an 8-year run as the flagship right there.
And in Scouting Fleet, the purpose of that was to seek out the enemy, to figure out how to engage, and there would be another fleet that would be called a a striking fleet or something like that. Admiral Cox, you probably know the right. But the whole point of it was you needed a fast fleet to go out and find the enemy. Remember, there was no radar back then. So you used things, you used aircraft, mostly biplanes in those days that were launched off of cruisers and sometimes aircraft carriers to find the fleet. And then once you found it, then there would be another fleet that would be brought to bear that may not be as fast, but they had bigger guns for the striking fleet.
Yeah, you know, that's something that's interesting. You bring that up, the aircraft on board, you know, gunboats, you know, like heavy cruisers and battleships. You see them on battleships in the pictures, you know, they're off on the stern back there. But Indianapolis and a lot of the cruisers of her era did not carry them on the stern. They carried them in hangars. She had a hangar, right?
She had two hangars, right? Yep. She did. And the catapults and the aircraft would land in the water and be craned back up on board. Yeah. And, again, remember, this whole concept was developed before radar. So the aircraft would be, they would do scouting and they would do gunnery spotting, you know, to tell you're shooting short or shooting to the right. You know, down one. They were very, they had to be sporty being launched off a catapult on an aircraft, on a cruiser, knowing that you got to land on the water and be craned aboard when you're done.
It's definitely a dangerous operation. So she carried those, not to jump too far ahead, but she carried those aircraft, or different varying types, throughout her entire life, did she not?
She did, yeah. She got newer aircraft in her final refit. Right before she got underway. And then, of course, the aircraft were removed for the final mission, which we're actually not going to say too much about, which carrying the atomic bomb to Tinian. And so they needed room in the hangars for some of the cargo. And so at least one and maybe both of the aircraft were removed for that final transit.
So Indy's fate is sealed when she brings parts of the bomb over to Tinian and then leaves. But she had a long wartime history. She earned 10 battle stars during her career.
She did.
And she was in a lot of places where there was a lot of heavy fighting, and fortuitously, she missed a lot of hot spots, like the Guadalcanal campaign, which probably actually saved her life, frankly, before she met her demise. On December 7th, 1941, even though her home port was Pearl Harbor at that time, she wasn't in... In Pearl, was she?
She was in the vicinity of Johnston Island for training, she was with I can't remember which carrier it was. You're going to tell me in a moment. That was delivering aircraft, and so, she was at sea, which meant she wasn't in port when the Pearl Harbor attack occurred.
Mm-hmm. She was like the most of the entire U.S. Pacific Fleet. She was operating on a war footing already. You know, Admiral Halsey famously, you know, told Enterprise and all of her consorts to, you know, operate on a war footing before December 7th even happened. Indianapolis was doing pretty much the same thing long before, well, I wouldn't say long before, but before the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. So it really didn't take her very long to get into the war. She had her own task force and was immediately absorbed into Task Force 12 as part of that force, and she searched in vain for the Japanese carriers of Kido Butai within the day and the day after the attack on Pearl Harbor. So she literally got into the war less than 24 hours after the Japanese.
Now, there was a lot of reforming, because I think just a few days after that, they reformed Task Force, and they established Task Force 11, and she was chopped, this is the Navy expression, to Task Force 11. But again, with the aircraft carrier Lexington, and then later Saratoga. Mm-hmm. And the Saratoga we've referred to in the podcast before as a torpedo magnet.
Indeed.
You want to talk about that, Seth?
Yeah, so Saratoga had a star-crossed career in the early part of the war. She liked to suck, well, I wouldn't say she liked to suck up torpedoes, but she took quite a few torpedoes. And in January 1942, she took her first torpedo from a Japanese submarine. And as such, Indy was no longer assigned to screen her. She was assigned to screen the USS Lexington CV-2, and that was the center of the task force. Indy's job was to provide anti-aircraft screening support for Lex.
Yeah, and we've talked at length about all of the issues that led up to the Guadalcanal campaign. Admiral King really pushed the Guadalcanal campaign. But throughout 1942, the momentum was building leading to Guadalcanal. And Indy had her first taste of action in early 42, didn't she?
She did. Yeah, you know, on February 20th, 1942, this is the part of the Pacific War that we refer to. We did an episode on this. We refer to as the hit-and-run carrier raids. This is when Admiral Halsey and Enterprise are going in there, and they're hitting Wake Island, Marcus Island, the Marshall Islands on February 1st, and then Lexington with India as her screen, and then later Yorktown. They're hitting these far-flung Japanese bases that you're going to hear a lot about in 1943 and 1944. Specifically, Indy was screening Lex when Lex launched attacks near Rabaul. And Rabaul, of course, at that time was starting to be built up as the main Japanese base in the Southwest Pacific. But by the time Guadalcanal and later, it is the main Japanese base in the Southwest Pacific, that and Truk, but that's another story for another day. When Lex had finished launching her aircraft, the Japanese retaliated, and they did send some aircraft to attack Lexington, I believe, of which there were 18 that were sortied against the American force. 16 were shot down by Lexington's combat air patrol. The remaining two were shot down by American anti-aircraft fire. We have no idea if Indy shot that one of those aircraft down. God knows, because everybody was shooting up at the air. And that's the thing, you know, you see ships get credited with an exorbitant amount of aircraft being shot down, like the one that comes to mind is South Dakota at Santa Cruz getting credit for 26. She didn't shoot down 26 aircraft. There's no way. The task force shot down 26 aircraft, and they might have fallen in the vicinity of South Dakota. But nobody knows who shot those airplanes down, but for sure, Indy played a part in it, no doubt.
Yeah, and then something happened just about a month later that Indy was involved in as well, wasn't it, Seth? The Ley Salamu raid, March 10th?
Yep. Yeah, the Ley Salamau raid on New Guinea on March 10th. This would be the last time that Indy would escort the Lexington carrier group, because right after this, Indy was sent back to Mare Island, which is right down the road over here, for a refit.
Yeah, and we'll be visiting Mare Island on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
We hope to share some of that with the viewers and listeners. But this is a repeating theme, though, because it was very common that for, you know, after a major period of operations, for ships to be brought back to sometimes Pearl Harbor if it's an emergency exigent situation, or Pearl Harbor Naval Shipyard would work on them. But if that wasn't possible, or if they needed more than Pearl Harbor could do, and remember at this point, they're still recovering from the Pearl Harbor attack, and a lot of the Pearl Harbor resources were being consumed by refloating ships and things like that that were sunk in Pearl Harbor. So Indy comes back to Mare Island right down the road for a refit. And this repeated pattern, right? And the other thing that's kind of unusual for modern sailors like me is that she often would receive a new skipper, even after 6, 7, 8 months of operations. In the submarine force today, we try to have stability with our skippers 3 years in command. But in Annapolis, it wasn't unusual for after just a few months for her to get a new skipper, and this happened throughout the war.
You know, and she, you'll hear repeated throughout the episode, she goes back to Mare Island, she goes back to Mare Island. It's not because she consistently needed repairs, it's because she was consistently at sea. And that's something to think about, is that she was at sea prior to December 7th, 1941. And then she was, I mean, she didn't stay out constantly during that period, but she was out a lot from, you know, December 7th until, what was the date? I said March 1942. So that's a long time for a ship to be operating under a heavy, heavy strain of sailing, combat, you know, all kinds of different incidents that needed her to come back to the United States for a refit. So it was, to be clear, is that she was really putting in her time. That's why she had to come back consistently.
And after that Mare Island refit was the Aleutians campaign, where Indy first really earned her bones. And you want to tell us about that, Seth?
Yeah, so she was, she after her refit, she was sent to the Aleutian Islands, which we did an episode with Admiral Cox talking about the Battle of the Komondorski Islands, which was up in the Aleutian, or near the Aleutians. We did an episode with John Parshall talking about the Aleutians, the battle for Attu that hadn't aired yet, by the way. But and he put it as literally the last place on Earth that any human being would want to serve, be it at sea or on the ground. And this is certainly, this falls into that category.
Yeah, I knew a lot of the Indianapolis sailors who were on board during that Aleutians campaign who talk about having to chip ice off of the lifelines and how miserable it was. They didn't have proper warm, cold weather clothing, and having to suffer through all of that on, you know, lookout watches and deck watches. And it's a suffering. And of course, we're fighting over these bits of land that are part of the United States territory. Ergo, we can't let them fall into Japanese hands. So political leaders feel compelled to do something about it, but they're of no benefit to anyone. They weren't any benefit to us. They weren't any benefit to the Japanese. The Japanese are doing it just because it's American territory, and it's about the only real American territory they could actually take.
And we're retaking it because it's American territory, not because we really wanted it. You know, Admiral King, when the Japanese invaded the Aleutians, or actually before they invaded the Aleutians, we knew they were coming. Admiral King, I like to say that he actually pretty much conceded the Aleutian Islands. We put up somewhat of a fight, but not very much. We put more of a fight into retaking them than we ever did to holding them in the first place.
And the Indianapolis got her first kill there, didn't she?
She did, yeah. She So during this period, we're talking March of 1943, the United States Navy is essentially blockading the islands of Attu, Kiska, and the Aleutian Islands up there because the Japanese are there. And we were fully aware that if we can keep supplies away from the Japanese garrisons on there, it's going to make it easier for when we A, recapture, and B, you know, these people aren't going to be in very good shape when we eventually do land over there because we're not going to, you know, allow them to get food or supplies or anything else. So the U.S. Navy, along with submarines, but specifically in this instance, surface ships, are patrolling an anti-shipping patrol line up there looking for anything that flies a Japanese flag to attack it and sink it. And in February, Indianapolis, in company with cruisers USS Coghlan, DD-606, and Gillespie, DD-609, were ordered to perform that very mission, anti-shipping patrol, following the bombardment of the Japanese garrison on Attu on February 18th. NDC something, don't you?
Yeah, Akagage Maru, which is a 1,100-ton merchant. And so, again, the whole point is we're going to starve them. Nature's going to freeze them. And then they're going to be weaker when we do retake these islands of American territory in the Aleutians. And she boarded one of her lookouts, one of those guys that we probably all met who froze up there in the northern Pacific, spotted this freighter, and Indy boarded to intercept. They challenged the unknown ship and actually received a response in Japanese Morse code, which is very unusual. Most of the times, the Japanese knew better than to do that. But it was easy to, because again, these merchant ships aren't, there's no target recognition. You can't put flashcards up to train people what they look like, and this is a bad guy or an enemy, because there's so many different classes of these merchant ships. So you had to positively ID them. You don't want to hit what we call white shipping, neither friendly or enemy, right? Neutral. And so you got to know what it is. And I guess the Akagage Maru made it a little easier by responding in Japanese Morse code.
Yeah, and as soon as he did that, the American fleet turned in to intercept. Indy opened fire with her main battery. Her third salvo scored on the Akagane Maru, and the ship burst into flames, but it didn't go down. Despite the fact that Indy was pumping 8-inch rounds into her, the thing would not die. The American destroyers in company with Indy charged in there to pump torpedoes into her, but I'll let you talk about the torpedoes.
What destroyers do, you sink a ship by letting water in the bottom, not air in the top. And so that's a torpedo. And so the Coghlan Mark charges in there and shoots torpedoes. And at this point in the war, our torpedoes still sucked. And these, some of them porpoise, some of them detonated prematurely. Submariners were going crazy, but the destroyers had the same problem. And so that didn't work.
Now, finally, she did die by gunfire. The destroyers pumped 5-inchers, hundreds of them, into this hulk, and it finally did send her down. But this is Indy's first kill. This is the first time she unleashes her main battery at an actual enemy target, and she hits. She hits several times, actually. Yeah. I don't know how many times, but she hit with several salvos.
This is a minor skirmish in the grand scheme, isn't it, Seth?
It is. It is. It's not a big fight, but for Indianapolis and the crew of Indianapolis, this is a big deal. This is what she was designed to do, was to attack enemy shipping, and she does this, and she does it well. She succeeds. But the thing is, it's great for her to sink that ship. Yay, you know, great thing. But what it does is, once this Japanese ship comes under fire, there are two other Japanese ships in this column that Indy...
To resupply the Japanese troops that are ashore.
Right, and the two other ships that are in column with this Akagane Maru that Indy never sees, they see Akagane Maru being lit up by 8-inch gunfire, and they're like, nope, and they turn around and they go, and they turn around and they go home. So the Japanese garrison is denied three ships worth of supplies that are destined for that garrison on Attu, which makes the job of the 7th Infantry Division that lands a few weeks later just a little bit easier. Not that it was easy, but a little bit easier than it possibly could have been.
No, it was still a tough fight, and the Japanese didn't give up, even as weak as they were. No. But then again, operating very hard, high speed, you know, runs, shooting your guns in wartime combat situation, you do this again, and it's time to go back and get another refit. So they come back here to Mare Island again.
Yeah, they do, and this is where Admiral Spruance raises his flag aboard USS Indianapolis, is right after this refit. And this is hugely important, not just because Spruance is there, and he's one of the greatest seagoing admirals in American history, and that's undeniable. And I'm not saying that because his grandchildren are in the room. That's true.
I said the same thing many times.
No, but it's God's honest truth. It really is. I mean, there's a short list of great American admirals, and he's certainly
in the top five.
Yeah, I'd say top three. But he, regardless of this, he chooses Indianapolis as his flagship, not just because Indy was designed to be a flagship, as we already said. And you said, you know, he wanted to be in a cruiser so he could get to where he needed to go. But also, Indianapolis... Spruance claimed Indianapolis as his hometown. And that's the theory. Part of the theory is that he wanted to sail aboard Indy.
His flag, right. Yep. Yeah. And he did for the rest of the war. So his first engagement with Spruance's flag flying, the Big Blue Fleet, what does that mean?
So this is the Central Pacific Force is what it was called in 1943. Later would be called the Fifth Fleet when it was under Spruance, and then the Third Fleet when it was under Halsey. Same ships, just different designations.
Now that's, again, we've said this before, but the same warfighting ships. But when Spruance was in command, it was the Fifth Fleet. When Halsey was in command, it was the Third Fleet. But the worker bees were still the same guys.
Absolutely, every time. Well, I mean, there were ships that would rotate in and out, but the vast majority of the ships were the capital ships were usually pretty much the same thing. The Big Blue Fleet, as we like to call it, this is the fleet that when you think of the U.S. Navy in World War II, this is what you think of. You know, the Essex-class carriers and Enterprise in there, and the battleships, the fast battleships, and the cruisers like Indy, and, you know, the Cleveland-class cruisers, all these new, modern, fast American ships that have been pumped out of the shipyard since the mid-30s until now, and they're continually being pumped out. This is the force that, in my opinion, wins the Pacific War in the way that we know.
Right.
You know, these are the guys that first set foot on Tarawa and then ended at Okinawa.
And we've been building up, I think we've done, as of the fact we're sitting right here, 26 or 27 episodes in season 2 alone, building up to Operation Galvanic.
Galvanic, yeah.
And so, and Galvanic is pivotal from a doctrinal standpoint, from a capability standpoint, it's what birthed what we call today the Navy SEALs and in World War II underwater demolition teams. So Galvanic is an inflection point in World War II. What is Galvanic, Seth?
It's huge. Operation Galvanic was the first step, if you will, of the Central Pacific Drive. Of course, this is the invasion of Tarawa Atoll, Baidoa Island, and in Macon Island, too, which you've heard about before. This is the operation that, if it fails, I'm not saying that the war ends or anything, that doesn't happen, but if it fails, the way we fight the war for the remainder of the war is likely very different than the way we actually do fight the war.
Yeah, we've been building up amphibious warfare doctrine since what essentially constituted administrative landings in Guadalcanal. And then we land on island after island after island during the Solomon's campaign, Bougainville being the one we talked about last. But Tarawa was it. I mean, Tarawa was, can we actually do this? Is the island hopping campaign, whoever birthed its Nimitz, you know, we can have that debate. Can we actually do it? And the fleet that was assembled for Galvanic was huge. Yes. Now, when you start talking 1944, it gets even huger, but this is 43. And so can you kind of summarize the size of this fleet for us, Seth?
Yeah, I can't remember it all off the top of my head, but I got it written down. So the escorting fleet for Operation Galvanic was, to your point, the largest amphibious operation of the Pacific War
to that point.
The escorting fleet under Spruance's command consisted of 17 aircraft carriers. Remember when we were talking about Guadalcanal and there was only Enterprise? 17 aircraft carriers, 12 battleships, 8 heavy cruisers, 4 light cruisers, 66 destroyers, and 36 transports. On board the transports were the 2nd Marine Division, which was slated to land on Bashiu Island, and the Army's 27th Infantry Division, which was slated to land on Macon Island. So this is a massive operation. This is something that the whole war to this point has been ready or been leading up to.
People are going
to
get tired of hearing me say this, Seth, but I'm going to say it again because our industrial base is what allowed us to go from one aircraft carrier in Guadalcanal to 17 at Tarawa. And Guadalcanal was August of 42, and now we're in November of 43, a little more than a year, maybe a year and a half later. And we've got 17 aircraft carriers. And why do I keep pointing that out? Because of how far we've fallen in the last 80 years in our industrial base capability. This is why I wrote that article, you know, who's the sleeping giant now? Because China has the capability to build those ships. God help us, we don't. And so, you know, if we've learned anything from World War II, it should be that point, that the industrial base is what allowed us to do this. And even with a force that size, we'll talk about this in a different episode. We're not here to talk about Tarawa.
Not yet.
You know, it didn't yet, right? It didn't go very well for us. But what was Indy's role?
So Indy's role, along with most of the surface ships of that task force, at least the ones that were around Bateo Island and the Tarawa Atoll, were to provide gunfire, naval gunfire support. So the Navy had talked it up big prior to Tarawa that this was going to be the largest, you know,
shore bombardment
in history. Yeah, that they were going to flatten Tarawa or Bateo.
There'd be nothing left alive.
Exactly, and of course that obviously
did not happen. We didn't bombard. Indy did bombard
the
beaches.
She did,
and we thought we had, bombarded long enough to make it relatively easy for the Marines to land, and that's not the way it played out.
Not at all. And I mean, despite their best efforts, the bombardment, you know, it went on and off and on and off for a period of about 3 hours if you combine all of them together in one big lump. And it was nothing compared to what was actually on Bateo. Regardless of this, Indy performed her role well, like they all did. They just didn't shoot long enough is what it amounted to. But what Indianapolis did do later on, which is undeniable, was provide close-in gunfire support for the Marines when they were ashore.
As they were landing, yeah.
And while they were fighting.
And, of course, we got to give the Japanese credit. They were way more clever than I think we gave them credit for, building bunkers out of coconut logs and things like that. They were way more effective than I think that anybody expected them to be.
Absolutely. You know, the Marines, specifically at Bateo, you know, because we have all these aircraft carriers offshore and we have all these aircraft, and the Marines would consistently say, do not send in aircraft, because the aircraft consistently would strafe and attack our lines, our positions, whereas the naval gunfire did not. You know, they would consistently request, when they would say, do you need air support? I mean, there's radio transmissions of this. Do you need air support? And the Marines would say, do not send air support. Don't send them here. And they would call in naval gunfire. Indianapolis
was
one of those ships.
It was accurate. It just wasn't as effective as we hoped it would be. So, yeah, Tarawa turns out to be a very sad point in Marine Corps history. The Navy Marine Corps team didn't do as well as we could. But Indy did everything that was asked of her then.
She did, and we talked about shooting down airplanes. This is where she gets credit for her first kill, actually, as she shoots down an aircraft.
Anti-aircraft kill, right?
Anti-aircraft, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, and that brings us to 1944, and she ends up getting back and getting another refit before, things get hot again in 44. Where did she participate then?
She's all over the place in 1944. Again, she's serving as Spruance's flagship, and that's what she does for the majority of 19. Whenever she's at sea in 1944, Ray Spruance has got his flag aboard Indy, and he's leading these assaults on these islands that you hear all throughout the Pacific: Kwajalein, Peleliu, Tinian, Saipan, Guam, all these hot spots in the Pacific, specifically the Mariana Islands, Saipan, Tinian, and Guam. Those were huge. And Indy's not only a Spruance aboard, she's providing close-in gunfire call support. She's shooting at targets specifically being requested by the Marines or the soldiers ashore, depending on the island. And she's providing shore bombardment.
Yeah, she had a pretty good reach with those 8-inch rifles, those guns on her. But she was often brought in close to the beach for this gunfire support. Why is that?
Well, she drew more water than a destroyer, but she could get in close enough to where she could actually provide some really heavy, accurate 8-inch rifle fire. And there's no way to know how many lives she did save, American lives that she did save. There's no way to know. Or how many Japanese lives she took. There's no way to know. But it is definitely, without a doubt, absolutely positive that naval gunfire support, specifically close-in gunfire support, in the Marianas, saved a lot of American lives and helped push those lines forward every little bit, every single time they were called in.
And we needed the Marianas, part of the island hopping campaign, as air bases. And, of course, Tinian in particular in the Marianas would come to play a very pivotal role in Indiana's future in 1945. But getting back to 44, after the landing at Marianas, there was another famous battle that got a kind of a nickname that the sailors called it because of the ineffectiveness of Japanese airplanes. And what was that battle?
That was the Marianas Turkey Shoot. So she was detached in mid part of June. On June 19th, she was sailing with the Big Blue Fleet, as we call her, providing anti-aircraft gunfire support for the fast carrier task force that was out there. Again, nobody knows how many airplanes were shot down by, Indianapolis or any other ship that was out there. But she was close in. The way most of those task forces were designed is that the carriers were in the middle, then the battle wagons, and then the cruisers and the destroyers. And, of course, there were destroyers around the carriers picking up, plane guard is what they were called. So Indy was essentially the second line of defense as the Japanese are coming in. They'd hit the destroyers first and then the cruisers and then the battle wagons and the carriers. Mm-hmm. So to put it in perspective, there were hundreds of Japanese aircraft that were launched on that day, on June 19th, 1944, that was designed to hit the American aircraft carriers, and no American aircraft carriers got a scratch. So think about that. Of the hundreds of Japanese airplanes that were sent out there, yes, a great many of them were shot down by American fighters, but a great many of them were shot down by anti-aircraft artillery as well that ships like Indianapolis provided.
Yeah. Guam was actually one of the last islands in the Marianas that we took because we were taking Saipan before Guam. In fact, I think the Japanese aircraft was still using Guam as a kind of a lily pad during the Marianas Turkey Shoot.
Rota, yeah.
When we finally did take it, and I've been in Guam's upper harbor 6 or 7 times with my submarine, but what was the first ship to pull into Guam upper harbor after we retook it?
It was CA-35, USS Indianapolis.
The other Indianapolis, right.
So right. My yeah, Indianapolis, not your Indianapolis.
Came in, that's right. So, I didn't know that at the time. I was pulling my Indianapolis into Guam, that the first American ship into upper harbor during the war was CA-35 Indianapolis.
Right, yeah, and there's no doubt that Admiral Spruance had a hand in that honor that was bestowed upon Indianapolis for sure.
Absolutely. So after went back to Mare Island again.
Yeah,
this sounds like a repeating
home,
theme,
yeah.
Right? And then she gets underway again, and there was an admiral we talked about during the Midway episodes, who was actually just a captain still then, named Mark Mitcher. And so how does Indianapolis get involved in all of that?
So Mark Mitcher, I'm not really sure how, but he attains flag rank after Midway, and he becomes...
Nimitz always believed in second chances,
clearly,
right?
Clearly, clearly. And he's the CEO of the Fast Carrier Task Force at this time. And Indy is again assigned as anti-aircraft screen for the fast carriers in February. These are operating off the Bonin Islands, and they're pushing closer and closer and closer to Japan, to the home islands. So obviously, Japanese defenses are getting a little hotter, shall we say. And the closer the American fleet gets to Japan, the hotter it's getting. So, and this is no different here.
Yeah, and you know, it's just one of those things where she, I think during this battle, we claimed a total of 499 Japanese aircraft destroyed during the raids, during these raids, while suffering losses of 49 American aircraft. So several more raids occurred on the home islands. And
yeah, these were huge in a morale-building thing, too. Not only, I mean, obviously they inflicted heavy damage on the Japanese, but this was a big morale-building thing for the Americans and a morale-bursting thing for the Japanese. Because mm-hmm. These aren't Army, this isn't Doolittle's 16 B-25s attacking, you know, penny ante targets,
which is borderline symbolic,
right? Which it was symbolic, let's be real. But
these are real. These did damage.
These were American carrier aircraft, fighters and dive bombers and Avengers that are coming, that you know have a very limited range. So that's telling the Japanese people that
we're close.
The American fleet is really
close. Right over the horizon.
So what your emperor is telling you ain't the truth, because we're right over here.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about Okinawa in a second, but remember, at this point in the war, the Japanese didn't know where we were going to strike next. And in fact, there was a faction within the Japanese army who firmly believed the next target, the next big battle, would occur on the Korean island of Jeju-do. And I mentioned in a previous episode that my wife and I were in Jeju-do just a few months ago, and there were caves ducking in the mountains where suicide surface craft were being assembled to fend off the American fleet that they were absolutely convinced we're going to hit Jeju-do next and the Jeju Island. And so, but that's not where we went. We went to Okinawa. And, you know, I'm sure that there was another faction within the Japanese Army and Navy who knew that sooner or later we were going to hit some Japanese island. But again, Okinawa is a stronghold for Japan, and it was Japanese territory, unlike Jeju-do. So, unlike the Aleutians, which we frankly didn't really care about, they did care about Okinawa.
Absolutely, and Okinawa was a bloodbath. You know, from April 1st, 1945 until the campaign ended several months later, it was an absolute bloodbath, not just ashore, and we're not going to talk about Oki now, we will later, but not just ashore, but in the air and at sea. You know, there were more American sailors that were killed and wounded at Okinawa than there were at Guadalcanal, and that's saying something.
Yeah, and there were more sailors killed during the Guadalcanal campaign than there were Marines. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about that before. But this is where the story gets very familiar to the Indy families, because everybody knows about the kamikaze attack. And before we get to that point, I think what people don't quite realize is how early in the Okinawa campaign that attack really occurred.
It was.
It was before the major landings began, right?
It was. It was part of the Okinawa campaign, but it wasn't part of the actual invasion. This is in March of 1945 that the kamikaze attack on Indianapolis occurs. The kamikazes had first reared their ugly head, or terrifying head, however you want to look at it, in October 1944 in the Philippines during the Battle of Leyte Gulf. There were several instances previous to that of Japanese suicide pilots crashing their aircraft, USS Hornet being one, CV-8, into American ships. But this became a tactic and a weapon after 1944. And when you get around Okinawa, that's not the only thing that's coming at you, but that's the primary Japanese air offensive that's coming at you, are kamikazes or aircraft that are at least flying
again,
with kamikazes.
We don't want to, tell people things they already know, but of course, the issue was the Japanese had lost so many pilots, experienced pilots, at this point of the war, that they didn't have time to train pilots for anything other than you're going to take off, you're going to fly your airplane into a ship. Now, it wasn't just kamikaze pilots and airplanes. We had they had suicide rocket planes. They had obviously suicide submarine, suicide torpedoes, the Kaiten. They had and they had suicide surface ships. And so they were anything that could be used to kill an American, even if the Japanese died in the process, was being configured to do that.
No doubt. And you know, if you think about it, until this point, Indianapolis had fired her anti-aircraft suite many, many times. But it was sporadic. You know, the Turkey Shoot was one, you know, Tarawa was another. And there were times here and there where she would engage enemy aircraft. However, as part of Task Force 54, which was one of the bombardment forces, Indy and her consorts came under kamikaze attack several times. Over a period of 7 days, Indy poured thousands of rounds into Okinawa while also fending off Japanese suicide attacks. Get this, in 7 days, Indy's AAA gunner shot down 6 enemy aircraft and damaged a further 2. So until this point, she'd only been credited with 2 airplanes shot down, and in 7 days, she shot down 6. So that'll tell you how, and damaged another 2. That'll tell you how many aircraft are coming at, not just her, but that task force. That much lead was having to be thrown up to stop these airplanes. They were relentless.
And the gun crews were, you know, cleared to fire anytime they felt it necessary.
Yeah.
And in fact, I think on the day we're going to talk about here, where the kamikaze actually got through, Captain McVeigh, I don't think knew one was inbound. He was reported to run out onto the bridge wing after he heard the anti-aircraft fire and yell out, "Who's that trigger-happy son of a..." And then he saw the airplane coming in.
Yeah, it was March 31st is the date you're talking about specifically. And often when the Japanese would attack suicide tactics or even just regular bombing tactics, which this happened to, we don't know if this was a suicide attack or if this was a straight bombing attack. This airplane did drop a bomb, but we don't know if it was, you know, separate. But regardless of this, when they would attack, they would either attack a lot of times early in the morning or late in the evening. So it was more difficult to see. You've talked about this several times, you know, different parts of the day. It's a hell of a lot harder to see things in the morning or the evening. This is no different here. The kamikaze comes out of the sun. The 20-millimeter gun on Indianapolis had reportedly less than 15 seconds to react. The airplane was on Indianapolis before the guys really had time to do anything about it, except
because they had 40-millimeter Bofors on board as well. And normally the progression is the Bofors would engage before the 20-millimeters engage, and I don't even think the Bofors had time to see it.
And
react.
No, they didn't. The 20-millimeter gunners up on the near the bridge were the first guys that opened fire. Like I said, they had reportedly 15 seconds. The Japanese aircraft was a Ki-43 Oscar, which was a fighter. It carried a bomb, though, at this specific instance. Indy's gunners, of course, opened fire, and it's thought that they at least hit the pilot because the airplane tried to swerve out of the way of the tracer fire and actually swerved into the way of the tracer fire. So more than likely, the pilot was either wounded or killed. And that's probably why he didn't actually crash his airplane into Indy, but we don't know. Regardless of this, what did happen is that the airplane did release its bomb and did and the bomb hit the ship, but the plane missed the ship and crashed into the ocean. But the bomb did significant damage.
Yeah, and I said earlier that the treaty cruiser limitations caused the belt armor to be thinner, which might have impacted the torpedo attack. But you said the lack of armor might actually have benefited the Indianapolis in one incident. What did you mean by that?
So the bomb that was dropped by the pilot crashed through Indy's steel deck, which, as we said, was 2.5 inches thick, blew through the crew's mess, kept going through the berthing compartments, pierced the ship's fuel tanks, came out underneath the keel before it exploded. What I meant by her thin skin is that had her skin been a little bit thicker, that AP bomb, which was very clearly an armor-piercing bomb, very likely would have exploded inside the ship, which would have caused significantly more damage and would have certainly killed more Indianapolis crewmen.
Yeah,
A lot of people in this room tonight might not be here.
That's correct, yeah. And again, we talk about the survivors and Chuck Gwynn, and this jumping way ahead, Chuck Gwynn seeing the people. Harold Bray, who's sitting here, our last living survivor, wouldn't be here if Chuck Gwynn hadn't cited, and a lot of the families of survivors, would never have been born. And so that's a big deal.
It's huge. I mean, if Indy's skin would have been a little bit thicker, this room might be a lot emptier than it is currently.
Right. Well, and we wouldn't know many of the stories that we've come to know about this great ship and crew. Of course, we talk about this amongst ourselves all the time. It took masterful damage control to counter flood, to get the ship righted, and get it back to where it was under its own power and got back to Mare Island. It did stop for some temporary repairs on the way, but eventually did get back to Mare Island, where it was finally repaired and upgraded.
It should be noted that there were 9 Indianapolis crewmen that were killed. When the bomb went off, it exploded underneath the keel, and it blew 2 holes up through Indy's belly. And that's why she took on the water that she did, and the damage control, as you were talking about, had to be performed. But there were 9 Indianapolis crewmen who lost their lives in that attack, and I believe 21 were wounded, if I'm not mistaken, off the top of my head. Mm. But, again, what you were saying, to your point, Bill, she does get back to Mare Island again. Well, she goes to get temporary repairs and then comes back to Mare Island for permanent repairs. And, of course, this is where our story is going to end for today. Anyway.
Our story for today ends there, because obviously the rest of the story is well known by not just everyone in this room, but frankly, probably all of our viewers and listeners, about being selected to carry the components. And we've done a separate episode with Admiral Sam Cox, Director of Naval History and Heritage Command, who's with us today. We're very happy to see him again. About the atomic bomb, that by the time this airs, that episode on the atomic bomb would already have aired, where we talk about, among many other things, what it means that she carried components of the atomic bomb. So look to that episode if you're curious about that. And, and then the final transit, and the rescue, recovery, that's going to be in a separate episode. So we'll film that at a later date, probably during our 1945 season, which will be season 4 if we keep on track the way it...
Maybe season 10, who knows?
Yeah.
Can't shut up.
So, again, 10 battle stars is significant in the annals of every World War II ship, isn't it, Seth?
For sure, yeah. 10 battle stars is nothing to sneeze at. I mean, there were ships who had more. Obviously, there were ships who had less. You know, Indianapolis is in the middle of the pack there. And, and I'll talk about this tomorrow night, Saturday night. But, there were things that Indianapolis was unable to take part in for various reasons, not the least of which she was under refit or she was deployed elsewhere or whatever the case may be, that very well may have saved her life, not the least of which is the Guadalcanal campaign. She wasn't there, and God knows she was needed, but she wasn't there. And
how many
well,
cruisers survived that Guadalcanal?
Heavy cruisers? Not very many.
Yeah, not very many. Most of the cruisers that were in the Guadalcanal campaign were sunk or taken out of action.
Great many. Yeah. Well, you want to do some Q&A?
Yeah, I think we're going to try this. And so we've never played Stump the Chump on our podcast before. And so this is your opportunity to ask questions. If you have them, they could be on any Indianapolis topic. We're happy to tell you we don't know if we don't know.
Or any topic at all.
Yeah, any topic. Any World War II related topic.
My name is David Stamm. My father was Florian Stamm. Seaman Second Class. He came on the ship April of 44. Can you tell me what the outlook was for the war at that time, or what the status, or what they thought the progress would be?
From April 1944?
Yeah. Correct.
That moment in history, April 44, how was the war going for us? I think that's what you're asking, right?
Right. When he came on the ship, what was he... Or what was
facing still a very determined enemy in the Japanese. I mean, they were by no means defeated at all. I mean, if you look at the rest of 1944, you see he came aboard in April 44. Mm-hmm. You got the Battle of Leyte Gulf, which occurs in October 1944. You got Philippine Sea, which occurs in June of 1944. You got the whole rigmarole off the shores of Okinawa that, last months. So, I mean, this is... If you look at the history of the Pacific War, the first 6 months, December 7th, 41 to Midway, June 4th, 1942, is, you know, defeat after defeat after defeat for the United States. And there's a few victories here and there, and of course Midway's a big one. And then Guadalcanal is a slugfest. It's just a bloody slugfest. So the war was, you know, you don't want to sit here and say that the war was decided already, but for all intents and purposes, it was. We were going to win that war. Everybody knew we were going to win that war. Hell, the Japanese knew we were going to win that war. But the period of 1944 to 1945 was without doubt the bloodiest part of the Pacific War. There's no question. In terms of casualties, both ashore and at sea and in the air, 1944 from really April, in the middle of 1944 until the end of the war in 1945 was the worst. It was absolutely the worst.
Thank you, gentlemen. My father never mentioned the war growing up, never mentioned that he was on the Indianapolis. This really helps shed light on his life before we were born and what he went through. So thank you very much.
And I remember your dad well. He was a great American, great sailor, and we miss him terribly, and Florian Stamm. So thank you for coming today. And, you know, that's true. The fact that he never mentioned it is so true about all of our World War II heroes. When they came home, they just started living their life and put that behind them. You know, there wasn't any therapy groups. There wasn't any, you know, comfort dogs. There was just work and forget it. And the ones who could cope, coped. And the ones who couldn't often climbed into a bottle. And that was basically the only options they had to them. So, you know, guys like your dad, like Harold here, you know, we can never give them the justice that they deserve for what they went through during that war. So thank you for coming. Any other questions? All right.
Thank you so much for your discussion. My name is Gina Pitts, and I am niece of Lost at Sea crewman Albert Rice. You made reference to the frequent leadership changes in comparison to today's Navy. Can you elaborate on the rationale behind that and perhaps at that time, and then perhaps how that might have impacted Indy's successes or some of the failures?
The interesting thing, we've talked about this on the podcast before, as it pertains to submarine COs, is during the war, there was, I think, a fairly well-proven theory that that skippers, in particular, would burn out after a certain amount of, in the submarine case, war patrols of intense operations with all that pressure on a single human being. So in the submarine force, I think most skippers generally got rotated after about five war patrols, right, Seth? And in the surface ship, it's curious to me, and it's actually a question I was thinking of posing to Admiral Cox, who's with us today, and the rotation occurred on capital ships, at least, more frequently than the submarine COs. Submarine COs ended up spending about a year, if that's how long it took to do five war patrols in command before they were replaced because they figured they were just done. And I suspect there's something similar going on with the capital ships, surface ship COs. But Seth, do you know?
No, I don't.
Like I said, we'd be happy to say when we don't know. Admiral Cox, do you know?
No, I don't know everything, but the fleet was expanding so fast that there are more and more ships rotate the skippers. They've made flag officers. There were more task groups. There were more. It was just a function of just the rapidly expanding size of the fleet, and you just moved up.
Oh, wow. So it's not the burnout factor that I thought it was, and so glad to have you here to answer these questions. Thanks. All right. David Bogart, grandson of Admiral Spruance.
And it's a personal question. Of the 10 battle stars that the ship was awarded, how many of those were for her service as a flagship of the 5th Fleet?
Oh, God, I knew you were going to ask me that when you were walking up here.
I was told to ask you that.
hold on, let me think. Again, Admiral Cox could kick in with this. Of the 10, I want to say seven?
Seven.
Was it seven that were awarded under Spruance's leadership?
Oh, yeah.
I'm pretty sure it was, because the first three, let's see, it would have been the carrier raids in 1942. No, the first
one.
He's not. And then the Aleutians, and then there was another one in there somewhere.
Yeah.
There were three early ones that he was not aboard. So of the 10, seven. It would be seven, yeah.
Well, again, we're so grateful you're here at the, this is now the 78th anniversary of the rescue of the USS Indianapolis Sailors coming up later this month. Actually, it's August is when it actually happened. And we're still in July. And so happy that we can have the opportunity to keep the stories alive, like the survivors would say every year when we got together. And I've been meeting with them since 1998. Keep the story alive. And this is yet another opportunity to do that. Thank you very much.
So with that, we want to thank you for listening in on our conversation. Please subscribe to the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. Wherever you receive your podcast, give us a rating and review. We do appreciate it. Also, if you want to see the video version of this very here recording, tune in to our YouTube channel called the Unauthorized History of the Pacific War podcast. If you have a question, send us an email at unauthorizedpacificpodcast@gmail.com. Once again, my name is Seth Paradin. Thank you all very much for not only sitting here tonight, but for having me here with you guys tonight. It is a pleasure and an honor. Bill.
And I'm Bill Toady. See you again next week.